This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The fact that nature knows no borders, birds don't have passports. What happens in Turkey affects people in southern Iraq. What happens in Saudi Arabia affects people in southern Iraq. It's all interconnected.
We're not very used to hearing good news about Iraq these days, nor is there an abundance of feel-good stories about the Earth's dwindling wetlands. So when today's guest successfully launched an effort to restore the Mesopotamian marshlands in southern Iraq, which had been drained, poisoned, and burned under Saddam Hussein in the mid-90s, it got a fair amount of attention. Azam Awash went about refilling these wetlands, once an abundant area for diverse wildlife, by gathering support in Iraq's prickly political landscape and applying his own complex understanding of hydraulic engineering. The struggle is far from over, but given the heroic actions he's taken, it's no surprise Awash is the most recent winner of the Goldman Prize, the environmental equivalent of the Oscars, and today's guest on Sea Change Radio. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Azam Awash. He is the founder of Nature Iraq, as well as the 2013 recipient of the Goldman Prize. Azam, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
First, tell us your journey from Iraq to the U.S., back to Iraq, and how this delicate region that you've helped restore, the marshes, has played a role in your return.
Well, the word Iraq brings to the mind of your listeners images of oil, of desert, of war, of Saddam Hussein, weapons of mass destruction. The word Iraq brings to my mind images of snow-capped mountains, majestic valleys that yield their water to these two major huge rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, which then go into this magical water world in southern Iraq. In the middle of a barren desert, there is this wonderful water world in which I spent a portion of my childhood. My father was an irrigation engineer in southern Iraq, and being that he was the irrigation engineer in an agricultural area, he was a very important man and therefore a very busy man. And my memories of the only times that I had him all for myself were the times when we were visiting the marshes in small boats, going around in these small little streams, surrounded by reed beds that go to the sky, at least to my child's mind, child's eye. I have very vivid memories of looking over the boat into this clear water and seeing these large fish dart away. And every now and then you land into this big lake, the breeze hitting your face, cooling you down. It's an incredible, incredible world. Words just don't describe it. Pictures don't describe it enough. You have to be there to experience this incredible, wonderful world.
This is southern Iraq.
This is southern Iraq. This is not the desert of Saudi Arabia. This is where agriculture was invented, by the way.
And civilization's birthplace.
Civilization started in southern Iraq. Ur was built there. Abraham, our common link between the three monolithic religions. It is where writing was invented. It is where the wheel was invented. And so... this world is not known by many Iraqis. You have to be in southern Iraq to really experience it. Not many people have seen this world. Thesiger, an explorer from Britain, saw it in the 30s, 40s, and 50s and wrote about it. Maxwell as well. But very few foreigners have seen it either. I left Iraq in 1978 before Saddam became president, but Saddam was the strongman of Iraq. And I left Iraq. I was not a political activist. I was basically, I left Iraq because, in fact, I was being harassed to join the Ba'ath Party, and I didn't want to join the Ba'ath Party. So I came to the United States in 1978 to study, to continue my studies. And I finished my PhD in Southern California in 1988.
I'm sorry, and what is your PhD in?
I studied civil engineering in California State University in Fullerton, and then I moved on to USC to finish my PhD there in 1988 in civil engineering as well, where I met my wife, who had a PhD in geology. And by then, the Iraq-Iran war was going on, and who wants to go back? And I basically established myself in the United States. I joined a firm, Pacific Soil Engineering, and soon enough, I became a principal. And soon enough, I was making money, and soon enough, I was the house. I had the house, I had the two kids, and you know, the typical American success story of an immigrant who came with nothing. 2003 comes about, and of course, my wife and I were actually avid kayakers. And so we were going around Southern California, going to these wetlands, and we marvel at the wetlands, and I keep on telling her, oh, just wait until Iraq stabilizes, and I can take you to the most beautiful wetland there was, my marshes. But by 1995, 1994, we began hearing stories about the marshes being dried. And my civil engineer in me, the civil engineering training in me, I was like, how can he dry the Everglades? How can he dry an area twice as large as the Everglades? You know, it's impossible to dry the marshes. You cannot dry the marshes of the Iraq. Well, soon enough, I found out that I was wrong.
And what were the motivations behind drying the marshes from Saddam's perspective?
The stated policy of Iraq was that they were going to recover the marshes for agricultural production, as if every arable piece of land in Iraq has already been developed for agriculture. Reality is the marshes have been our Sherwood Forest from the time of the Sumerians. It is where the rebels went to escape the wrath of the Sheriff of Ur or Sheriff of Baghdad, whoever happens to be in charge. You see, organized armies cannot go inside these marshes. These are wetlands. Armor cannot get into these in these marshes.
And so, guerrilla warfare can thrive, I imagine.
Exactly, guerrilla warfare is the method of work, and that's where the rebels have an advantage over organized armies. So following 1991 defeat of Saddam, out of the 18 provinces of Iraq, 14 went out in rebellion. Soon thereafter, Schwarzkopf allowed Saddam to use helicopters, and the rebellion was crushed. The remnants of the rebels went into the marshes, as their ancestors have done, to escape the wrath of Saddam.
This is an area twice as large as the Florida Everglades.
Indeed. It's about 15,000 square kilometers, 6,000 square miles. and it increases and decreases depending on how much flooding happens in each given year. So Saddam was afraid that these rebels will be used by the West to undermine his rule. So he set about, at a time when Iraq was not allowed to sell a single drop of oil, he set about using literally every piece of available equipment in Iraq to excavate six major rivers, build thousands of kilometers of embankments, essentially holding the waters of the Tigris and Euphrates and preventing them from going into the marshes, diverting the waters of the Tigris and Euphrates into the desert and then into the Gulf, depriving the marshes of their source of livelihood, of their oxygen, of the water. Without water, marshes cannot exist.
Said I'd lead you the lowlands, where the sad-eyed prophet say that no man comes. Now should I lead them by your gate? Oh, sad-eyed lady, should I wait?
To
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Azam Awash. He is the 2013 Goldman Prize winner and the founder of Nature Iraq. Azam, you're an engineer, and just purely from an engineering perspective, you must have been impressed with this vast undertaking of Saddam Hussein's to drain these enormous wetlands.
Indeed. I mean, it's like, wow. It's like, I thought it could not be done. And so I have admirations for the Iraqi engineers that did it. But it was one of those projects that even the United Nations, an organization not known for using very strong words to condemn a member nation, United Nations Environmental Program called the drying of the marshes the worst engineered environmental disaster of the last century. Huh? These are fighting words in United Nations terminology. So, in about 3 years, about 450,000 people who had depended on the marshes in one way or another, who lived inside the marshes or dependent on activity around the marshes too for their livelihood, became deprived of a way of making a living. And they had to migrate inside Iraq. Some of them became refugees in Iran. Some of them went to Saudi Arabia.
What about the wildlife in this area?
Oh, if mankind has to leave, guess what happens to wildlife? I mean, these marshes used to be an engine for the biodiversity of the region. It is the place. In fact, the drying of the marshes was documented by KISR, the Kuwaiti Institute for Scientific Research, to have caused the landing of the shrimp in the Gulf to be half as much as it was before. The fisheries were half as much. The temperature in the area increased by an average of 5 degrees centigrade as a result of the drying of these marshes. You see, they're swamps, right? They act as coolers. And the drying of the marshes increased the incident of dust storms. And so that effect is not only bad on human beings, but bad on the wildlife, bad even on the environment.
Give us an idea of the timeline there.
Yes, the drying of the marshes began in earnest in 1992. By 1997, they were completely dried, or only 7% of the marshes remained. It's an area between Iraq and Iran that Iraq was not able to kill because water was coming in from Iran. By 1997, it was done, and the first time I saw it was 2003. And let me tell you, at first I saw it from satellite pictures, and conceptually, satellite pictures, you can see a dried area. You compare it to 1973 and you see the drying. But there's nothing like seeing the devastation up personal, up close. The first time I saw the marshes dead, my marshes dead, was in June 2003. And while I had prepared myself mentally, I was not prepared enough to see the devastation.
And were you still a California resident at this point, just visiting?
Yeah, I was visiting. I went June 2003 for a 2 weeks expedition to see my homeland, as it were, to see the marshes.
Post-Saddam trip.
This is post-Saddam. Saddam was out for 2 months. Saddam was still alive, running around, hiding in one hole or another. But the chaos in Iraq had not started yet. So I went back to Iraq to see whether the marshes can be restored or not. I mean, between 1998 and 2003, I was going about advocating for the marshes, pointing out that the evidence of weapon of mass destruction that the West was looking for is right underneath its nose, that in fact the deprivation of water was used as a weapon of mass destruction to destroy a civilization that lasted 7,000 years. Incidentally, in May of 2003, I was in a conference where a marsh advocate or marsh Arabs advocate was claiming that the marshes or the marsh Arabs don't want to come back. They've become agricultural farmers, that they have lost the skills needed to survive in the marshes. Some experts in biology and in environment were saying to me that the seed bank is too old, that the marshes cannot be really restored, that the chemistry of the soil was changed. All sorts of horror stories. And then there were people saying there's not enough water in the region. What are you doing talking about the marshes? We don't have enough water to feed the people, let alone create wetlands. And so I went to Iraq in June 2003 with trepidations. I did not know what the situation was going to look like. I was thinking that I have to convince Marsh Arabs that the restoration of the Marsh is in their interest. I was under the impression that I would have to plead the case that the restoration of the Marsh is needed.
Had the environmental advocate part of you been, had the fire been lit at this point?
No, I will say I am a wetland hugger. I'm a reed hugger. I am, you know, I'm pro marshes. I just want to restore my childhood place. I had not become.
You were still working as an engineer in Los Angeles.
I was still working as an engineer. I was still helping developers turn nice little wild areas in Southern California into tract homes. That's how I was making my money, and so. When I went back in 2003, the pleasant surprise to me was that marsh restoration has already begun, that the marsh Arabs have already started breaching the dikes to restore the water into the marshes. But being that they really did not know water, they are not engineers, the method was very haphazard, not organized, not very connected. And so I spent between June and August agonizing nights trying to figure out, what am I going to do? To leave the comfortable life in Southern California with two young children, it's a hard decision. It's not an easy decision. And to go to the uncertainty of what?
This was a dangerous area too.
Well, it wasn't dangerous at the time, but still, I mean,
it's a war.
It's a war, and you know, there's no income. And in the end, I decided that if I don't do it, then I will regret it for the next 25 years or whatever, however many years I had left on life, on this earth. And so I decided, you know what? Let me go give it a shot. And it's a year, 2 years, and I'll come back. Well, first of all, it's a lot more than 2 years. It's 10 years hence, and the project is still not done. But I was naive enough to think that, you know what? We can do this in 2 years. Be that as it may, I went back to Iraq to start looking at the restoration and start basically going around the areas that have been restored already, trying to understand from nature what works. Some areas were coming back robustly. Some areas were, you know, 6 months after the water restoration, still no reeds. So I started studying and understanding from nature what works. Turns out it's really very simple. You let the water in, shallow areas, and you let the water through. You don't hold it in place. And you make sure that the water flow is continuous. So basically, I started using my scientific knowledge to help Iraqis, to help Marsh Arabs breach the dikes, breach the rivers in areas that are strategic, that will allow the restoration for the largest amount of marsh and for the quickest restoration and the most robust restoration possible. That was about a year and a half of work. And then we came up with a master plan for the management of the water resources to address the concerns of those who would say that there is limited water resources in Iraq. And then we start about convincing the Ministry of Water Resources to implement the plan. And fortunately, we were successful. And the plan has been implemented now. And then we came up with the idea that we need to preserve these marshes for the future generation. These marshes don't belong just to Iraq. They belong to the entire world. They are the cradle of civilization. And in a sense, the only way to make sure that my grandchildren and your grandchildren have a place to connect with their past is to make sure that this has become a national park. And so the work on the national park idea began in 2006 in earnest. By 2007, 2008, we had finished the management plan, but then we entered the nightmare of trying to get the national park designated. This was never done in Iraq before. Bureaucratic nightmare, red tape between the Ministry of Water Resources and the Ministry of Environment. It's been an arduous task. But you know what? As of a month ago, it has been designated as a national park. The Iraq first national park is the marshes of the central marshes of Mesopotamia.
Easy go connect them dry bones, easy go connect them dry bones, easy go connect them dry bones. Now hear the word of the Lord. Well, your toe bone connected to your foot bone.
bone, your foot bone connected to you. Heel bone connected to you. Ankle bone, your ankle bone connected to you. Leg bone connected to you. Knee bone connected to you. Thigh bone connected to you. Hip bone connected to you. Back bone connected to you. Shoulder bone connected to you. Neck bone connected to you. Head bone, now hear the word of the Lord. Them bones gonna walk around.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the founder of Nature Iraq, Azam Awash. So you just mentioned how the marshland were just designated a national park. How did the U.S. occupation play a part in the massive red tape that you must have gone through as an organization?
America has nothing to do with this except making the restoration possible. The removal of Saddam Hussein was instrumental in making the restoration possible. Had Saddam been in place, the marshes would never be restored. We'd be talking about a dead area now, actually. 2 years into this project, I was asked, when do you consider this project done? And I said, when we declare the national park. Guess what? The national park has been declared.
So you're done.
Not nearly. You know, it shows you how little I knew. You see, the marshes are only a small piece of the puzzle of the environment of Iraq. While it's very important to me personally, the marshes are, as a personal connection to my past, to my childhood, it is only one piece of a very, very complicated puzzle. I mentioned to you the bureaucratic nightmare and who's going to control the Ministry of Environment. Is this under the purview of the Ministry of Water Resources? And then just the negotiation between the ministries. And what takes you here to do a week, it takes us a month to 2 months in Iraq to do. And that's because of the war, because of the chaos, because of the bureaucracy, because of the socialist attitude that was left over from Saddam Hussein, because of the corruption, too. I mean, you know, it's a combination of everything. The religious holidays. The nightmare of Iraq is Iraq has many, many, many problems. And of course, here I am advocating for the environment in a country that's at war. So a lot of people roll their eyes when they see me. It's like, here he comes talking about the environment. Who cares about the environment when we're dying?
But by the same token, a lot of people here in the States who may be frustrated with an environmental issue and may not even have the energy to go fight the building of a coal plant in their neighborhood or whatever that seemingly large issue is confronting them, most of us don't actually get off and are duffs and do something about it. But and that's in a country that's not in a completely war-torn, crisis-laden time period. This is the end result of 3 decades of war, and the environmental catastrophe must be hard to quantify.
You hit the nail on the head. I mean, the drying of the marshes was basically the crowning jewel of Saddam's crimes against Iraq. Let's not talk about the mass graves. Let's not talk about the Iraq-Iran war. The marshes, the dying of the marshes was just like the coup de grace, they say. It was the last crime he did against the environment of Iraq. During the Iraq-Iran war, which lasted 8 years, there was an incredible militarization. Industrial complex got built. Manufacturing high explosives, manufacturing munitions. Iraq has been using the Tigris and Euphrates as open sewers. And as long as there was enough water coming down the marshes, coming down the Tigris and Euphrates, dilution was the solution to pollution. And so we really never really stressed in Iraq on the environment because, first of all, we were not really much of an industrial nation in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. We were just growing. We were just building the infrastructure.
A lot of oil revenue coming.
There's a lot of oil revenue. And the oil is being produced in Kirkuk in the desert in southern Iraq. A portion of the marshes was dry to produce oil. But by and large, the crimes against the environment was limited. The industrialization of Iraq was very minimal. there's only 192 state-owned industries. But in the 80s, there was a lot of crimes done against the environment. All these the military-industrial places were dumping their sewage or their leftovers into the waters of the Tigris and Euphrates. And strangely enough, as long as the marshes were in existence, and they were in existence in the 80s, they acted as a buffer between Iraq and the Gulf. They acted as a kidney. I mean, in fact, you can see it in the satellite pictures. You can compare the 1973 pictures to the 1980s pictures, and you can see that the reed beds are not as thick, as not as full of life as they were in the 70s. And that was because they were being strained. They were being basically, the reed beds were cleaning the waters of the Tigris and Euphrates, which were more laden with toxins, with heavy metals. But at least they acted as a buffer to the rest of the world, to the Gulf.
The Persian Gulf.
Persian Gulf or the Arabian Gulf, depending on what you want to call it. We don't want to start another controversy.
Oh, I didn't know. What is? I never heard of that.
Oh, there's a huge controversy between Iraq and Iran, between the Arabs and the Iranians about what's the name of the Gulf.
Oh, I didn't
now
know
we
that.
Call it the Gulf, just to be politically correct. It's neither Arab nor Persian.
Let's go with the Gulf. We've had so many issues here in our own Gulf of Mexico, which I think the way we've been treating it, there's not going to be any argument over we call it the Gulf of the U.S. or the Gulf of Mexico anytime soon.
Well, actually, they mentioned the Gulf of Mexico. Actually, in Iraq, between Iraq and Turkey, something is developing akin to the United States and Mexico. I mean, let's talk about it. So we talked about the environmental concerns. I mean, the restoration of the marshes actually, you know, once I was secure that the marshes are partially restored and they're going to continue to exist, I started putting my eyes on the rest of the environment of Iraq. And so I'm looking at the Tigris and Euphrates, and I'm thinking, my goodness, not a single city in Iraq has a functioning sewage treatment plant. Literally, we're still using the Tigris and Euphrates as open sewers. Literally. That's not good. Not good for the people. I mean, if you're living in southern Iraq, you are literally drinking the sewage of the rest of the basin. So I started looking at that picture, and I started looking at the sources of the water of the Tigris and Euphrates. And soon enough, I began understanding the ecology. I mean, I'm an engineer. What do I know about biology? And so I'm starting educating myself about the entire biological system of the basin. The fact that nature knows borders, no borders. Birds don't have passports. What happens in Turkey affects people in southern Iraq. What happens in Saudi Arabia affects people in southern Iraq. It's all interconnected. Nature supersedes us. And I'm looking at the map, and I'm started to study Iraq all over again from a different perspective, from a perspective of an engineer, perspective of an ecologist. And I'm looking at southern Iraq. Southern Iraq is a sedimentary plain. Where does the sediments means that it's soil transported to southern Iraq. You look at the map, heck, southern Iraq is actually soil from the mountains of Kurdistan. So in a sense, southern Iraq is a gift of the mountains of Kurdistan to the people of southern Iraq. So this Kurds versus Arab, I keep on telling my Kurdish and Arabic friends, like, you know, what are you guys arguing about? You know, if you Kurds are talking about disputed lands and you want Kirkuk, I would say, if I were you, I'd demand Basra, because the soil of southern Iraq belongs to the mountains of Kurdistan. So, you know, and it preceded you all. It preceded humanity. This has been in here for 10, 13,000 years since the beginning of the Holocene Age. What are you guys talking about? You know, just learn to live together.
Please tune in next week for the second half of my discussion with 2013 Goldman Prize winner Azam Awash.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Jerry Garcia and David Grisman, Bob Dylan, and the Delta Rhythm Boys. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.